From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1857 when the United States Supreme Court issued its decision in the case officially known as Dred Scott v. Sanford. Dred Scott was a man who had been born into slavery around 1799 and had pursued legal remedies to win his freedom. He married a woman named Harriet Robinson in the Wisconsin Territory, where slavery was outlawed. Their enslaver was a man named John Emerson, who died in 1843, and his wife Irene became Dred and Harriet's enslaver, and Dred tried to buy his freedom from her. She had refused. So in April of 1846, Dred and Harriet filed separate lawsuits for freedom based on two Missouri statutes. One of those statutes said that any person taken to a free territory automatically became free themselves and could not be re-enslaved. Dred and Harriet had lived in Illinois and the Wisconsin Territory, so they thought they had a strong case for freedom. For a decade, there were decisions and appeals, with Dred winning in 1850, Irene appealing and winning in 1852, and then Irene attempting to transfer slave ownership to her brother, John Sanford. The U.S. Supreme Court took up the case in February of 1856, and by then, this was a high-profile case that had attracted the attention of abolitionists. But in 1857, the Supreme Court decided that, no, Dred and Harriet were not entitled to freedom, and the reasoning of the court is telling. As Jeannie Suk Gerson recently explained in The New Yorker, the Supreme Court held that Scott did not even have the privilege to bring the suit because, as a black person, he could not be a citizen within the meaning of the U.S. Constitution. Suk Gerson writes, quote, "The problem was that, under the Constitution, in order to bring this suit, it's about citizenship. And to arrive at the conclusion that Dred Scott was not a citizen, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney zeroed in on the statement in the Declaration of Independence that it was self-evident that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. If the Founding Fathers intended to include black people in that declaration while personally enslaving them, well, Taney reasoned, that would mean that the Founding Fathers were hypocrites who would have deserved and received universal rebuke and reprobation. But Taney found it impossible that these great men acted in a manner so utterly and flagrantly inconsistent with the principles they asserted. And so, the justice concluded that instead, their intent really was to exclude black people from the American political community. Of the two possibilities, grotesque hypocrisy or white supremacy, Justice Taney found the latter far more plausible," end quote. And then Suk Gerson turns her attention to what Justice Taney further said about black people in the U.S. Constitution. This can be undoubtedly difficult to hear, but the fact is that the Supreme Court made this decision precisely because it found the legal backing to deny rights to black people. Taney said that black people were, quote, "regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect," end quote. Justice Taney pointed to the Constitution's slave trade clause as just one piece of evidence that our much-celebrated legal document did not, in fact, confer on black people the blessings of liberty or any of the personal rights so carefully provided for the citizen. Those are Justice Taney's words. The Supreme Court was making it clear that our founders believed that all white men were created equal. How much do you know about the Dred Scott case? Does it ring a bell? In recent years, conservative lawmakers and conservative commentators, generally speaking here, there are exceptions, but they've pushed for cases like this to be excluded from American history books or given much less attention. And that's because they claim this was just a mistake. The Supreme Court made a bad decision, a racist decision, but that didn't reflect what our country was truly about. Why focus so much on this outlier case, they say. But many black scholars have pushed back, saying this was no mistake. Hard as it is, look at the language used by the court. The justices were not rogue actors injecting their personal bigotry into law with no basis. They were ruling based on the very Constitution that is so revered by so many today. They found white supremacy right there in the founding documents. And in many ways, this is what critical race theory is about. Forget the hysterical culture war, cable news shouting matches. CRT is aimed at offering an honest assessment of what the country has been, how it was created, and what it was intended to be. The Dred Scott decision is telling. But now, as Suk Gerson notes in The New Yorker, there's a renewed conversation about removing the Dred Scott case from law classes, or at least scaling it way down. This push comes not necessarily from conservative commentators, but from a progressive-minded law professor at the University of Buffalo. Sue Gerson writes about University at Buffalo law professor Matthew Stylin, who felt so moved by the murder of George Floyd that he reexamined what he was teaching law students, and he decided that teaching the Dred Scott case was just too painful. He told Sue Gerson, quote, "Taney is making the case that black people who were enslaved were never part of the people of the United States and could never be citizens. It's just painful. I'm white, and I'm going to stand up there and talk with the students, including black students, about this stuff. I would be dragging them through stuff that was hurtful to them. It just felt indefensible. I wasn't comfortable giving his words to my students because I was afraid it would hurt them and destroy the kind of community I want to foster in class," end quote. So where would that leave us? What's the right approach to teaching history and law, even or especially the most devastating chapters? We asked Professor Stylin to come on the show today, and he has graciously accepted the invitation. And you can forgive the long introduction there, Professor Stylin, but the rest of the hour is yours. I'm really glad that you're here. Thank you for making time for the program today, Matthew.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here. Great introduction, Evan.
And Natalie Ann Knott is an assistant public defender who's back with us, and it's nice to see you in studio. Thank you for being here.
Nice to see you, Evan. I'm excited to talk with you, Professor.
So, Professor, let me just start there and ask you to elaborate a little bit. Number one, on how you were moved following the murder of George Floyd and how you were examining or re-examining what you were teaching and why.
Sure. Well, I've been teaching constitutional law for 10 years now. In the last 5 years of that time, I was using my own materials. So I went through, selected cases, edited all the cases, put them together with commentary. I'm a legal historian, so my version of constitutional law was heavily historical. And there was quite a bit of material on slavery in that version of the class. When the unrest of last summer happened following the murder of George Floyd, I did really have a moment of intellectual crisis where I started to think about what it meant for me to stand up in front of my class and give them my packaged version of American history. I was asking myself whether I needed a different perspective, whether I was confident that I was giving them a full, accurate, complete, insightful version of our history. And I felt my race mattered. I mean, I felt that my experience growing up white in relatively affluent upper middle class Minnesota was not the experience of a lot of my black students. And I wanted to deliver a class that created an environment in which they felt trust and safety and could invest in class and become part of class discussions on an equal footing with everyone else. So I went back and looked at materials. I chose a different casebook. I abandoned my own materials because I wanted a different perspective. I chose a casebook authored by an eminent legal historian who had done quite a bit of work on slavery, Paul Finkelman, who's now president of Gratz College in Pennsylvania. And I was looking at how he and his co-authors had edited Dred Scott. And I looked back at that language and I just thought about what that would mean after a summer of so much pain, what effect it would have on my class, what effect it would have on my ability to construct a vision of the American constitutional order that invited all the students to make the necessary intellectual and emotional investment to succeed and be part of class. And I just, I had this moment of doubt. I mean, this is what Twitter's for. You have moments of frustration and doubt, and you just express them, and then it got picked up by the wider world.
Are you surprised it had the velocity it did?
I was surprised. Most of the time, Twitter's like shouting into a void. And maybe that's appropriate, when you have momentary reactions, not all of them deserve to be preserved shared, but widely shared at least. I was surprised, and I was surprised principally by the reactions of my left-leaning friends. I mean, I am liberal myself. And I was teaching a class that was informed, I thought, by critical perspectives, left perspectives. But the tenor of their response, the anger, And the refusal to consider the effect on students really did surprise me.
Before I get Natalie Ann's thoughts on this, can I just ask, has your position on this, on teaching Dred Scott or not, moved at all since this all went sort of nationally viral?
Well, so first of all, I should clarify that I never supported excising Dred Scott from the curriculum. I did not, in fact, remove the case. I did not assign the full version of the case included in the textbook that I selected. But as I told Professor Gerson when she talked with me before she wrote her article, I didn't want to remove the case because the case is an essential part of American history. Mm-hmm. That view I still hold. And it's largely consistent, I think, with the reaction that this little tweet eventually generated. A lot of the reaction, I think, was based on the mistaken premise that I had proposed omitting it entirely. I don't really think that's defensible in a law school classroom or an American history classroom. Has my view changed as a result of the response? Well, it's evolving. I mean, I was, as I said, expressing a momentary frustration and really posing a question rather than giving an answer. Mm-hmm. And, I've written quite a bit on the importance of race in understanding early American law. I think the place of slavery in the original U.S. Constitution and the meaning of the 14th Amendment are obviously vital parts of a common law course. And, you know, they have to remain in the course and centered in the course. I guess I would say this. I am still convinced that one does have to be sensitive to the world around one as a teacher and to where students are coming from. You can't just teach in a void with some kind of idealized conception of what you want the students to come away with. You have to work with what you have if you want to be effective. That view I still have. And so I would probably edit Dred Scott the same way next year without committing to doing the same way forever in the future.
What do you think, Natalie Ann?
Well, I want to say I applaud the professor's I applaud where he's coming from. I'm a black attorney, so of course, once upon a time, I was a black student, and I was predominantly taught the American history from white teachers and white professors who frequently never thought to consider the students in the room who might be going through something traumatic in the way that these topics are often taught. I applaud the sentiment behind this, and I applaud the consideration that the professor is trying to show for black students. My one point of disagreement in this is that I think that there is a way to teach the full ugly case of Dred Scott v. Sanford while also demonstrating respect and care for black law students. I had the benefit. I went to Northeastern University School of Law, and I took con law from Professor Margaret Burnham, who is a black woman, who taught Dred Scott in its entirety. And one of the things that I got from her, and I got from my law school education and my legal education as a lawyer in general, is that the law is frequently very ugly. Dred Scott is, to me, as a criminal defense practitioner, more the norm than it is the outlier. And so I think there is a way to teach the full ugliness of Dred Scott. And it is ugly. It is ugly. It is traumatic to read. It is hard to read. But as lawyers, especially black lawyers, we are going to be confronted with that. We are going to be confronted with that over and over again. Maybe not in quite the plain language that Justice Taney uses, but it is going to be present. It's going to be present not just for us, but for our clients. If we happen to go into a practice where we are representing a large number of Black clients, like I do as a public defender. So while I applaud the sentiment behind it, I don't necessarily think we are doing law students, particularly Black law students, any favors by cutting out the more horrific parts of that case.
You also, before the program began, Natalie Ann, you mentioned to me that it's important to keep in mind that as awful as the words of this justice are, and the court is, Black law students are not going to be blindsided with it. There is an understanding, whether it's lived experience or just a study of history going into a class like that.
Exactly. By the time, I mean, Professor, you said something really interesting, that you want your Black law students to be on an equal footing with all the other law students in their class. And I got to tell you, by the time a Black student gets to law school, they are not equal to their peers. They have typically, usually, had to overcome a lot more than their peers to even get to their seat in law school. We can talk about, the racism inherent in the LSAT, that, the entrance exam to get you into law school. This program has talked frequently about, racism in the K-12 system. All of these students, by the time we get to law school, have already endured an amount of racism that Justice Taney would probably be happy existed. So this is not, as Evan said, this is not unfamiliar language. These are not unfamiliar. These are not unfamiliar terms. I think also a lot of Black students become lawyers, go to law school because they know this exists, because they know that their citizenship in this country is perpetually conditional. And Dred Scott and the other quote unquote anti-canon cases, Plessy versus Ferguson, Korematsu, that are called the anti-canon, I would say are honestly far more in line with American jurisprudence up until this date than they are outliers. So hiding the reality of Justice Taney's words from Black students, to me, would come off as a bit patronizing. There is a way to be in solidarity with your Black students without kind of pretending that the ugliness doesn't exist. Acknowledging the ugliness, acknowledging that the reality of this ugliness is present in the practice of law even today. Those are incredible ways to be in solidarity with Black law students and to create that very safe community that you would want to create, which I commend in so many ways, than being in solidarity with the reality of law as opposed to kind of softening it a little bit, I think is a better approach towards creating that community you are trying to create, admirably so.
Professor Stylin, you want to react there?
Well, yeah. So the first thing is every case gets edited, and it's edited with a view to what's important and what's essential and what's not. Editing Dred Scott is a question of what's essential to what you're trying to do in constitutional law. And in constitutional law, I'm both educating the students about American history, and I'm also trying to create a sense of understanding and investment in the constitutional system, and in particular, in lawyers' special roles in the American constitutional system. As many lawyer jokes as lawyers have had to suffer, the truth of the matter is that America greatly privileges lawyers, looks to lawyers for guidance about the meaning of the Constitution. And my aim is to give birth to those people, to help them, to develop people so that they're ready to play that role. So what that means is the vision of the American constitutional order that I create has to have some redeeming quality to it. It's going to be real, Yeah, but it has to have something that would lead someone to think that there's something going on there other than the mere exercise of power, subordination, hierarchy, and domination. The story has to have two parts to it. It has to have the reality of the early constitutional order and the forms of racial subordination that existed, but it also has to have a sort of living, breathing thing, a form of political and legal ordering that lawyers play a role in. So I edit Dred Scott in a way that shows its role in that system. And I want to do it so that I'm including everyone in the classroom. If the classroom makes an intellectual exercise out of considering language that humiliates, subordinates, rehearses the domination and exclusion of one group pointlessly, you know, we all know that the language is there. If I make a point of sort of parading it in the classroom, it doesn't serve the goal that I've identified. I mean, it can oftentimes undermine that goal. For as strong as Black law students are, maybe, people are in all sorts of different places. And you realize that when you're in a teacher. They are going through all sorts of things. They're coming from all sorts of backgrounds. And you have to be quite careful about what you're introducing into the classroom if you want to achieve the goal you have. So I don't think that there's a tremendous amount of intellectual value out of introducing sort of symbolic humiliation of one category of students, you know, then telling them, oh, well, don't worry, we've rejected this now, or even telling them, oh, that was the core of the system. I mean, the result is their marginalization in the classroom, their refusal, understandably, to invest in the system, and I can't achieve the goal that I have. So it's a balancing act, you know, and my concern, especially after George Floyd, was, you know, fetishizing the humiliation of one group of my students. I'm not interested in that.
Can I just ask one follow-up question? I'm sure Natalie Ann wants to. It seems to me that you've sort of kind of bifurcated your options. I mean, like, you seem to think that the two options you have are, not engaging or going over the language of Justice Taney in the classroom for the reasons that you've stated, or parading the language in a way that is sort of gratuitous and hurtful. Isn't there a way to engage with the language that is obviously awful and hurtful, but if it is an important part of our own American record and understanding, as Natalie Ann, I think, has powerfully stated, not an outlier case, but relying on our very Constitution to justify racism, isn't there a way to do that that doesn't parade it or flaunt it, but teach it in ways that are both direct but sensitive?
I mean, that's a great question. And the answer is yes. And you can assign material and not make it the subject of class discussion. Anytime you make text the subject of class discussion, you know, it's like asking a question in a courtroom. There's a risk that it goes sideways, and you always want to know what the answer is before you ask the question. You know, so you have to have a plan with the text that you plan to use in class. Again, because you want class to go in a particular direction, you have particular pedagogical goals in mind. So the answer to the question is yes. The reason I talk about parading is that if something isn't strictly necessary, you know, if I'm not using the language with a particular point in mind, then I'm just showing it. You know, and if I'm just showing it, if I'm just accumulating evidence, at some point, the cost of displaying it and rehearsing the subordination of one group of students outweighs the pedagogical benefit. Yeah, yes, lawyer, you've made your point. No. We know what the reality of this system. It does come at a cost for some people to go over language that points them out, and it unsettles and disrupts the classroom in a way that some classrooms can handle if there's sufficient trust and the environment's right, but other classrooms can't, or even good classrooms on bad days. So you have to think carefully and proceed cautiously when you use that kind of language.
Natalie Ann Nutt?
Well, I guess I want to go back to something you said, Professor, about trying to create, I mean, you're trying to teach students to invest in the legal system. They already have. They are law students sitting in your class, and you want to kind of be able to teach them some kind of optimism about the constitutional system and the legal system in whole that originated from the constitutional system. And I think that is the mission of most law schools and most law school classes. But I think that often that is somewhat of a bit misguided mission. I think that the arc of law school does teach you optimism in the constitutional system. It does teach you, you are taught some, you know, through various classes that through the law, most things are possible if you bring the right case and fight hard enough. But I think where a lot of, especially Black lawyers, when they come out of law school and they come into the actual practice of law, and they realize that it is not an optimistic system. It is a system that can be very ugly and unjust at times. And hopefully you've had experience of how ugly and unjust law and legal discussions and interacting with your colleagues can get in the law school setting. It's kind of your trainer on how to deal with that, how to negotiate with people who don't necessarily think you belong in their classroom, at their table, in their presence. Because there are those people in law school, and often that sometimes can be the source of very ugly classroom interactions. But it's through those ugly classroom interactions, ideally with a sensitive and empathetic professor like yourselves, that Black students can learn how to navigate those horrible interactions and can learn how to make arguments that can counteract those interactions and learn how to, and honestly, I mean, we don't talk about this enough in law school or as lawyers, how to think and process when you are incredibly emotionally affected. Because as we know from science, you know, when you are emotionally distraught, it inhibits your ability to think and act as well as you might normally if you were not upset. So all of those experiences, while unpleasant and uncomfortable, are really valuable parts of the law school education that I think get missed when you don't try to navigate through the rougher waters of rougher cases. And again, Professor, I completely applaud what you're trying to do, because I discussed this case and this appearance with my law school interns right now, and they raised concerns about how Dred Scott was taught in their class. Again, it was also taught by a white male professor who specifically wanted to focus on like the dispassionate, you know, legal arguments that Tanny was relying upon to come to his verdict. And as you can probably imagine, a dispassionate discussion of Dred Scott is almost as bad as someone who is teaching Dred Scott from, let's say, the viewpoint of Justice Tanny. That's just as affecting because, of course, it's not acknowledging the trauma that some students are going through just from reading this case. And you are completely right. It is a trauma to read Justice Tanny's opinion if you are a Black student. I remember that well myself. But I ultimately think that it is really important for Black students for I hesitate to say steer into, because I think that goes, that crosses the line into what you were talking about as being gratuitous about the language, but to really engage with the ugliness and also to engage with the echoes of this ugliness that still exists in our system, such as, like, say, the 13th Amendment, which, you know, says no slavery, but we're keeping a loophole. Well, why did we keep that loophole? We kept that loophole because the same people who supported the Dred Scott decision still had and have a significant toehold in American jurisprudence. And to deny that is to deny the reality of what we're sending Black law, the practice that we're sending Black law students into.
Talking to Natalie Ann Knott, an assistant public defender, and Matthew Stylin, a law professor at the University of Buffalo, who has, I think, been really gracious with his time in offering his concern about teaching all of the really awful, racist, horrifying language of Justice Taney and the Dred Scott decision. And I want to ask the professor about another aspect of this. While acknowledging and appreciating right from the start here that the impact on Black students should be centered and should be the focus here, one of the reasons I wanted to see if Professor Stylin would come on this program to engage is because he is teaching law and he's preparing future lawyers. But, you know, there are echoes in the decisions we make on this program and what are the subjects we engage with on this program? Who do we invite on this program? How do we address difficult and even racist material on this program? And those are tough decisions as well. And I can promise listeners that the entire team here is thinking about that often, and we fail often. There's no doubt we fail often, but we are thinking about how to get better all the time with that. So when I read what Professor Stylin was saying about his classroom, I was thinking about, boy, you know, there are similar questions we ask. Well, right now, eventually we're going to have to get back to grappling with critical race theory, because there's a moral panic going on that is mostly based on a caricature, a cartoon of something that's not really what CRT is supposed to be about. But what I see is a pretty big group of, to speak monolithically, white Americans, often in suburbs or rural settings, who are worried that what critical race theory is teaching your white kids to hate being white or hate themselves. And the first thing they often say is, like, this is not a racist country. Like, we are not, we're just not. Like, don't tell me that. And if you take the most painful parts of Dred Scott away as a teaching tool, even in the best intention, you are removing one of the best tools to help people see it does not feel good to know this about us. But unless you believe this was just some wild, bigoted outlier justice who went against the grain of our country, which clearly that was not the case, then the possible harm is still today. It's not just not understanding the full context of what happened in 1857. Mm-hmm. It's now. It's understanding, how did we get here? Where are we right now? Why do these disparities exist? And where do we go from here? What are remedies? That's what I worry about, that And you may have white students in your class, Professor, who are not all that familiar with Dred Scott. I talked to a lot of people before this program. What do you know about Dred Scott? And they go, I think it's like, is it like Plessy? Which one was Plessy? Which one was Dred Scott? You hear that a lot. And, you know, they may know a little bit, but they don't really know. And then when you actually read them what Taney said, they go, oh, my God. Most classrooms, just history classrooms, social, are not engaging with that. And I think there's a loss in not being that honest with ourselves. That's what I worry about. But I don't question your motive, Professor. I hope what I'm saying makes sense there, and I'd love to hear where you are on that.
Well, we're in total agreement. I mean, and there's no way you could graduate from my course without an understanding of the place of race in human enslavement, the race slavery system, and the original constitutional order. Absolutely no way. I mean, not only do we read Dred Scott, we read the other anti-canon cases. They play a central role in the course. The meaning of the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court's refusal to enforce the 14th Amendment in its full scope of possibility in the 1880s and 1890s as the federal government retreated from Reconstruction. All of that plays a central role in the American, in the common law course that I teach. The question I was posing is when and whether it's necessary to show things, to identify and speak out loud in class and focus on what is insulting, demeaning, degrading, exclusionary language because of the effect it has on the environment of the classroom. So I 100% agree with your concern, and I think all three of us are sort of largely in agreement about those principles. It's about fine-tuning the classroom, which when you teach con law and you teach to a diverse student body like we do, you have to think about how you can deliver this content in a way that will capture everybody. So you're not telling anyone that they don't count. You're not telling anyone that they're always bad. You're not inspecting for the curiosity of other individuals, the subordination of one group of your students. You are building something together. You're constructing a system of legal decision making that everyone has a stake in. And so you have to be conscientious about the symbols, images, language, and the tone of the class. You can't just risk a tough classroom situation, right? Because you hope that it produces a learning experience. You're not experimenting on the people in the class. You are building humans, right? You're building humans by giving them a kind of professional capacity. So all of that is done carefully and conscientiously. And but there's no way to finish my con law course or any con law course I know of. From my friends who I communicated with this about now, in the course of the whole thing following on Twitter, there's no way of finishing any respectable con law course without coming away with a strong impression of the system of race subordination, domination, and violence that have existed throughout American history, as well as the perpetual effort to use the constitutional system to overcome that subordination.
Talking to Professor Matthew Stylin from the University of Buffalo, law professor there, I am very much late for the only break of the hour. Let's take that. We're going to come back and then want to engage in a couple of other points that Natalie Ann Knott raised as well. She's an assistant public defender and kind enough with her time here in studio. Matthew's in Buffalo. Let's take this break and we're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, Vladimir Putin did not move when it comes to the jailing of dissidents. But President Joe Biden says he thinks he sent a powerful message to Russia's leader. We talked to Professor Randy Stone about relations between the United States and Russia. In our second hour, preparing for Juneteenth, which is on its way to becoming a federal holiday, understanding its history. That's Friday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And you might have heard earlier in the program, Assistant Public Defender Natalie Ann Knott say that she's just concerned that the approach that the professor takes might be patronizing to black students. Now, the professor, I'm grateful that he's clarifying where he is on teaching this. It's not that if you go through his law program that you're not going to know sort of the substance of Dred Scott. And you may even be assigned reading of Taney and Dred Scott separate to a class. So there may be limits on what the professor will sort of tolerate in terms of a classroom discussion when it comes to Taney's really, really awful language. But you're not going to graduate without knowing the sum and substance of that. I take that point. But Professor, even if you say, look, we're going to assign the reading, our students are going to know what Taney's points were. We're gonna engage with what that means for us, but I'm going to draw the line in class. We're not going to read that language in class. It's too harmful, particularly to black students. If what Natalie Annott is saying is, that is a laudable goal here, but we can handle that. Like, that's patronizing to black students. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I would start by saying I have a duty of care for my students. So in some sense, I patronize my students in the sense that I think about their well-being when I decide about the content of the class. I don't think that's inappropriate. I'm the teacher. I know the material. I'm older and an experienced lawyer. They are none of those things. I'm teaching them. I occupy a position of privilege with respect to them. So they're humans, you know, so I owe them kind of respect. So I'm trying to care for them, and I'm making decisions on their behalf that reflect my, you know, being in a superior position relative to them. So you can call that patronizing. I think that's part of teaching. That's a defensible element of teaching. Now, there's a kind of patronizing that, you know, crosses the line where it goes from concern for or respect for students as human beings into a kind of disrespect because one doesn't hold them in any high regard, you know, belittling students, thinking they're incapable of doing something. And sometimes, you know, I take Natalie's point, or at least as I listened to her, I thought sometimes it can be difficult to spy the line between caring for students in a respectful way and belittling them. Sometimes when one thinks one's doing something for their good, one's actually not doing that at all. One's just sort of not giving them the chance to grow. But that is really a disagreement about, again, not about principles, not about really course design at a large level, but at the level of detail. And a lot of things will depend on context. Every class is different. You know, every group of students is different. You're managing a group of students with different individual personalities. Sometimes you have outspoken, dominant Black students who set the tone for the class and make certain things possible that wouldn't be possible otherwise. Sometimes you have outspoken, combative white students, you know, that really take up this issue of refusing responsibility for or acknowledgement of race subordination and violence. All of those things change how you want to calibrate the care that you're using in introducing material. So it's just a complex, but a kind of a granular thing.
Do you want to add to that, Natalia?
Yeah, and I completely would agree with the professor. It is, you have classes that can have more respectful discussions than others about really difficult things. It's a chemistry issue. And I think kind of in contravening what you said earlier, teaching is always a little bit of an experiment because the variables are always different. And you have to recalibrate for different energies and different contributions from different avenues. But I still don't think it does Black students a service to not have to grapple with very ugly things, very ugly aspects of the profession that they are hoping to take up in a training for a professional setting, which is essentially what law school is. And I also think it does the white students a big disservice. You cannot, and it kind of, again, goes to current issues we're having. If we never confront the full ugliness of what was done in our name, whether you, obviously, I'm guessing most of your students would not co-sign Justice Taney, but if we don't confront the ugliness of what was done in our name, both on the macro, as it happens in con law, and in the micro, when you get down to clinics and individual cases, we're not forcing white students to also confront their role in this system. And again, what was done in their name, what was done in their name to give them a lot of the privileges that they you know, experience today. Black people weren't considered people by Justice Taney because they were the property of white people. And that property enriched a lot of white people. And a lot of white people continue to live off the benefits of that enrichment. And I think really grappling with the reality of that, again, in a class like yours, I imagine it prior to when you re-edited the case, was always done with a significant amount of sensitivity and a significant about and care for your Black students in class. But to remove that from the discussion is still, even though it's incredibly well-meaning and incredibly, and I think very well thought out, is still doing Black students a disservice.
And white students.
It's doing the class a disservice for several reasons. You may have the white students who, as you said, may want to continually, you know, shirk responsibility, or not that they're responsible, obviously, for 19th century racism, but not see themselves and their role in this system. But this kind of language and this kind of discussion in a Supreme Court case really can have the ability to recontextualize how people see themselves in this system. And I think that that's a really important part of the legal education. It's not just learning about how the law works and how it's operated and what has happened in the past, but it's, especially when you're training to be a lawyer, it's contextualizing your own self in this system. What are you going to stand for? What are you going to stand against? And who are you standing with when you make those decisions? And I think kind of teaching a rather clinical explanation of Dred Scott, where you're focusing on either the legal principles, be they, you know, positive or negative, and the time period that Justice Taney is writing this in, and, you know, all of the surrounding political implications, that is also doing that's removing the context from the issue. And I think it's doing Black students a disservice because, you know, at the heart of the legal issue of Dred Scott is racial oppression. And the language of racial oppression is ugly and it's dehumanizing. And, you know, frequently when you take that con law class and you, after the Dred Scott decision, you will probably find all the Black students at a bar kind of detoxing from it. But again, like, that is what it is to practice law as a Black attorney. And I do think that law schools tend to, especially con law, con law was my favorite class, so I understand, tend to teach a more optimistic, you know, arc bending towards justice vision of the constitutional system. And I think most Black students, when they come out of law school and they begin practicing and they realize that's not the case, and it's hugely disillusioning. And I think that law professors could be doing a much better job, especially, I mean, in the con law class, of recontextualizing the constitutional system for a more accurate reflection of what it actually is and what it is becoming.
So let me just the professor respond a little bit and just maybe, as in our last couple of minutes, just address, are you concerned that you may be missing an opportunity, as Natalie Ann said, with your white students to get them to see what the system has been, perhaps how they've benefited, and what their future work might entail given that history?
Yeah, so I'll take this one at a time. So first, responding to Natalie's excellent points. They give me food for thought. And as I said at the beginning, I really was posing a question rather than giving an answer.
Sure, yeah, sure.
And all of this is evolving. But let me tell you what I envision happening if things go wrong. It's not my Black students detoxing at the bar, as Natalie put it. It's me losing a third of the class that becomes perpetually silent. People go home and, you know, they're crying or whatever. They refuse to participate in con law. They don't read. they don't get anything out of the class. They don't have an understanding of the constitutional order because they refuse to invest in a class where they're being subordinated or humiliated or injured in front of everybody else. So I don't accomplish my goals. And it's not, when I hear Natalie, I hear somebody really speaking from a position of significant accomplishment, you know, and power, reflecting back on her education and appreciating now from this perspective the reality of the system and the ways in which her education foreshadowed her experience today. But, you know, that's not who my students always are, and that's not the direction they're always headed in. And the effect isn't always that they'll then get to a position and appreciate having been exposed to the rough edges early. I mean, there are other outcomes that are possible. And so I am trying to prevent some of those negative and destructive outcomes. And we're talking about real human people and real human lives. And, you know, people really do suffer in medical, physical ways, in some cases. So I'm thinking about all that when I'm designing a class. And when I said I'm not going to experiment on someone, I'm not going to just take a chance that if somebody gets humiliated in class, it becomes somehow part of an exercise in which they get something out of it. Like, they're not an instrument. They're not, you know, to some other end. They're a person. They're an end in themselves, and they have to be treated that way. Am I worried about my white students? Of course.
About 25 seconds, Professor. We're going to be out of time. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm worried about everyone in the classroom, including white students. But I'm mostly worried about creating a community, because the practice of law is not about an individual black attorney or an individual white attorney. It's about collaborative decision making according to a system that is legal rather than political or violent. And that's the system I'm trying to communicate.
I've got to say, Professor, I greatly appreciate the time and for at least engaging on this. You've certainly sparked a lot of conversation, and I'm grateful for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Stylin's a law professor at the University of Buffalo. Natalie Ann Knott, assistant public defender. Always great having you. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
For Mike Black Engineering, Megan Mack, MRA Stein, Evan Dawson saying thanks, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.